Hello, sports fans, and welcome to the second episode of the Edge of Autonomy podcast. This is Amon Kidwai, manager of the UConn blog, here with Ryan Smith of the SB Nation USF site, Voodoo 5. You may recall the initial installment of the Edge of Autonomy podcast and its pilot season coming in with great critical acclaim a few months ago. And actually, we just decided to wait a little while until we could do it on a week-to-week basis. No, just kidding. We actually did record a second podcast, and I even remember telling Ryan the second one's always the toughest, and that's exactly what it proved to be. We recorded a great second podcast.
It was a fantastic podcast on women's basketball.
It really was. And we took an alternative angle. We brought in Colin Sherwin, great guy, manager of Voodoo 5. We primarily talked about women's hoops because we're zigging when others zag. We talked about the We talked about the USF assistant coach who was only there for a few weeks.
Oh, right. I almost forgot about that one.
And then we talked about a UConn offensive coordinator hire that I'm still not too sure about. But then, unfortunately, some malware on my computer zapped that podcast, and it was destroyed in the ether of the interwebs. So really, the only part of that podcast which is not stale news by now is actually a segment where you get to know a little bit more about my co-host here, Ryan. For those of you who don't know, Ryan is a rising senior at Emory University.
Unfortunately.
And we can get into that later. He's a rising senior at Emory, and he's from Philadelphia. And so one might feel compelled to ask, Ryan, why on earth are you a USF fan? So would you care to catch everyone up on why in God's name you root for the USF Bulls?
That is a great question. And people do give me that a lot when they discover that I'm from Philadelphia and do not go to USF. So it will be nice to have something to point them to now. But anyway, when I was younger, I would say maybe sixth grade or so.
Can you give us a year?
2006. I would ballpark maybe 2005.
Sure.
I started getting really into college football, and Philadelphia, fantastic place. You know, love the city. It's a great sports city. People are really into their sports, but there is no college sports presence in Philadelphia whatsoever. And you know, I say that having never really met a Temple fan, especially back then when they were still. I think they were conference-less back then, actually. And, you know, there are no Rutgers fans in Philadelphia, thank God. But point is, I needed a team to follow. And instead of making my life significantly easier and picking an Alabama or Texas, I kind of wanted something that could, like, that I could grow up alongside. And USF filled that void, and, you know, I had my eye on them. They were up and coming back then. They had Matt Grothy in his first year. He was really exciting. But, you know, you can't just make yourself look at a team and say, okay, I'm a fan of them, or else I would probably just point to Alabama right now and, you know, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, all my USF memories. But unfortunately, since I can't do that, you know, USF was very, very exciting back then, and it's almost tough to believe now, given how horrible of a offense they were on. But, you know, they had a freshman quarterback. They were just like 10 years removed, even less, I think, back then from not even having a football program.
Yep.
And they were in the Big East, their first year in the Big East in 2007. You know, I started talking them up to all my friends because, you know, a couple like dark horse USF previews, the first of many, many to come. There was a time, I'm sure we can all remember, when they were the hot topic every single offseason.
No, now they didn't. College sports fans have the memory of goldfish, so.
True. So. Very true and very unfortunate. But anyway, so I was talking them up to all my friends. I was saying, yeah, this team USF, I was pretty into them last year. I think they're going to be really good this year. And obviously no one cared. It was Philadelphia, and no one cares about college sports, let alone the University of South Florida. And it was just funny because, like, all the things that I was saying were going to happen actually came true in the first half of 2007. They beat Auburn on the road. They beat West Virginia at home, got in the top five, got up to number two. And that run there really cemented my love for them because it was just like it was perfect timing. And they were just so exciting to watch. And, you know, after you're a kid watching three-step drops from NFL quarterbacks, like, again and again and again and again, and then you see, like, Matt Grothy, this 5'10" quarterback scrambling around over, like, 20 people in the backfield and running into loops and throwing a 50-yard pass, it's very tough not to fall in love with that. And so it just kind of developed from there. And unfortunately, it stuck me where I am now.
All right. So there you go, everyone. There are people on this earth with no affiliation to the state of Florida or the University of South Florida who are fans. So anything is possible, really.
You said people? That might be inaccurate. It might just be person.
Right. We're talking about someone from Philadelphia.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So pretty interesting stuff, Ryan. A little bit of a hipster college sports fan.
I used to, like, when describing the story to people, I would call it, like, a sports hipster desire. That was, like, there was some desire to have something that was my own.
Yeah.
And that never ends well, as this story proves.
A hipster might ironically pick like Miami of Ohio or something like that because they're at the complete opposite end of the spectrum. You were doing due diligence. You were trying to find someone on an upward trajectory.
Yes.
That was exciting. You were just off as it turned out.
God forbid I had picked Miami of Ohio. I don't even know where I'd be right now.
Or Temple, who's actually somewhat decent now, but anyway.
Yeah, the cruel irony of all of this is the fact that Temple has a better football program than USF does right now. Now, in two seasons, that will probably be totally different, but as of right now, when we're speaking, Temple, the school that I actively spurned, is better than USF, which is just, like, horrible.
Yeah, it's kind of like watching Rutgers go to the Big Ten, and you're just like,
oh my god, it is very much like that.
Give me a freaking break. Well, speaking of the state of our respective football programs, Ryan and I actually both recently wrote articles for Underdog Dynasty, which is the site that covers AAC, Conference USA, Independent,
Sunbelt
football. There's already a MAC outlet. There's already a Mountain West outlet. So I guess that's the catch-all bucket for all the rest of them. That don't have.
I still forget that the WAC doesn't exist. I always want to say WAC in there.
Yeah, a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
So we both wrote some articles for Underdog Dynasty. Ryan actually wrote about the USF SMU game last year. The Underdog Dynasty manager actually asked me to write an erase this season for UConn sports, which I thought was kind of rude. I mean, we got the win against UCF at home. And launch,
which was the most beautiful thing in the world. We can all agree on that.
What would eventually become the civil conflict. So how dare you?
We have to address that at some point.
Oh, but we will. And I feel like we're going to be on opposite ends of the argument, interestingly enough. At any rate, I felt compelled to tell Nick, hey, wait, whoa, you know, there was some real silver lining to this UConn season. And single out one game that deserved to be erased from the UConn schedule, or the one that deserved to be erased the most. That was the 17-14 USF victory over UConn.
Oh my goodness.
In the torrential downpour at Raymond James Stadium in front of 17-25 rabid fans.
They were very, very rabid, I can tell you that much.
You have to be pretty dedicated to go to USF at Raymond James Stadium in the rain.
Oh, my God. And if there was any football game that deserved to be played in a torrential downpour, it was that one. Because both teams were just so incredibly offensively inept that I wish I could say the rain was even an excuse. But you take away the rain, and it's probably the exact same thing.
It would be interesting to kind of look into or try and figure out what that score would have been without the rain. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't see any more than 17-14 in terms of points by each team even under ideal conditions, and probably a pick six for UConn still, because we
there's always a pick six for UConn in USF games.
Non-offensive points between USF and UConn. I wrote an article about it actually before last year's USF game. I wrote an article about how ugly the UConn-USF rivalry has been.
If we only knew.
Last year, in front of a national audience on a Friday night on ESPN2, these teams put down the ultimate stinker, Bob Diaco, shutting down the passing game.
That was really the under-discussed part of that game, because everyone was talking about the rain and how they didn't move the ball at all. And those were definitely, very important storylines, especially, the pick six, which was absolutely one of the silliest plays I've ever seen. But Bob Diaco literally refused to pass the ball. And not like, I understand that when it's raining that much and you don't have a great quarterback, you're not going to pass the ball much. But I mean, he did not pass the ball much. He did not pass the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I have never in my life heard of anything like that in the world of sports. I mean, I can't even think if I've heard of a high school team shutting down the – I'm sure there's been a situation, but, I can't imagine in college football at the FBS level, no matter what the weather conditions are, the head coach saying we're just shutting down the passing game. And then actually in the fourth quarter, when we started passing again, and maybe it was just one of those prevent defense situations, but I don't think it was, we started to move the ball a little bit with the passing game. Oh!
Yeah, actually very effectively too. And, I go back and forth on this because sometimes I think, well, if UConn was passing the ball from the beginning, we'd have a totally different game. And then I go back and I think, well, UConn also had five total yards in the first half. And so maybe that wouldn't have made that much of a difference at the end of the day. But still, he really did himself a disservice in literally refusing to even pretend that he had heard of the concept of the forward pass.
It is truly a stunning thing. And I mean, again, I understand. So here's UConn's first half possessions, plays, yardage, and time. First possession, three plays, negative 11 yards, 135. That was a fumble. Chandler Whitmer was sack fumbled and USF recovered. Scored a touchdown in about, it says 2 minutes on the game clock. It felt quicker than that. Next UConn possession, three plays, 1 yard, 2 minutes, 27 seconds. We also had, you may recall, we had a number of false start penalties. We had a couple of holding penalties as well. That was that might have been why. Next possession, UConn possession, three plays, negative 5 yards, 1 minute, 9 seconds.
It was unbelievable. I mean, I had never seen an offense accomplish so little. And we've seen some terrible offenses.
Exactly. No, we've seen – I think UConn is – I wish I should just get this exact number, but I think UConn has not – before that fourth quarter kind of garbage time touchdown at the end of the game, UConn had not scored an offensive touchdown against USF in maybe 3 or 4 games.
Oh, my goodness.
And still had won two of them.
That is just a really sad commentary on the state of both football programs.
So that's the UConn-USF rivalry in a nutshell. Another glorious chapter to the most storied chapter or rivalry in AAC football history, I think.
I can only dread what this year is going to bring.
Yeah, this year, I mean, you guys, it's our homecoming game. We scheduled basically our only potentially winnable home game as home.
It was a good move. I can't blame them for that.
That was a smart move. I'm honestly, and this is funny, speaking of Philadelphia, we're opening the season with Villanova and actually kind of scared.
Yeah, Villanova's got a good football team.
Yeah.
I mean, relatively speaking anyway. I used to live about across the street from Villanova and used to go and watch, Brian Westbrook play there back in the day.
Yeah.
They've kept some momentum going. I think they should have beat Syracuse last year, right?
They very well should have. They very well should have. And this year they're returning their star quarterback, who I believe I believe he won the FCS Heisman or the.
I think you might be right.
So they're returning him, and they were ranked number 4 in a preseason FCS poll. So we're pretty scared of Villanova to open the season.
Oh my goodness! I mean, if there was a situation where an FBS team could open as an underdog to an FCS team, that seems like a strong contender.
I mean, I think UConn's going to be like -2 or something like
that. Oh my goodness.
Or maybe 3.5, if that, just because.
Well, it's a good thing that UConn and USF are programs with no history of losing to FCS schools.
Exactly, yeah. Of course not. Whose was more embarrassing, ours or yours?
Ours, absolutely. We lost by 32, I think.
McNeese State.
Yeah, we lost to McNeese State in the first game of the Willie Taggart era by 32. I mean, you look back on that now, and we must have had some really twisted optimism thinking that something good was going to come out of that tenure. Like, we were like, oh, he lost by 32 to McNeese State in the first game, but it'll be okay.
For us, that same year, we lost to Towson in the season opener. Okay, better FCS team, but that was Paul Pasqualoni's make or break year. You may recall he was
– I do remember that.
Fired 4 games into that season after we lost at Buffalo. But yes, we have a lot to look forward to with USF and UConn and many, many years of field goals and defensive and special teams touchdowns.
I'm looking at the box score from last year's game now, and you know how ESPN lists the top performers for passing, rushing, and receiving? The top passing performer, Chandler Whitmer, 88 yards, 1 touchdown.
That's actually bad.
that's how you know that it was not a pretty game.
That's better than I thought it would be when you were about to say it. So
that's not a bad point either.
Well, it might be a good segue to talk a little bit about this upcoming UConn season. I saw an article, you know, the title made me laugh, from Colin, I believe, earlier this summer about how he's already given up on US football this year.
Yes, he has.
Is that and I totally understand, because, well, for a lot of reasons, but is that a sentiment which most USF fans share?
I think that most USF fans think that, or at least have been given no reason to believe that this team is going to be good this year, or even decent. I mean, considering that the only argument you could possibly make is the team improved their win total last year and is getting more experienced technically. But they were not much better last year. I mean, we saw them. You couldn't even make the argument that they were worse. Mm-hmm. They didn't progress much. Their best quarterback transferred out. I mean, they're switching to a new offense, a spread offense, which in theory is a very good thing, because USF should be running a spread offense. That's just the type of athlete they get.
Yeah,
it makes sense. But the fact that Willie Taggart, after 2 years of basically saying, like, he was like, you know, the Sam Hinkie of USF, being like, trust the process. We're building from the ground up here. Like, we're doing it my way, and like, it'll be rough at first, but it will get there. And it's the fact that basically after 2 seasons, he then said, well, just kidding about all of that. We're going to run a spread.
Yeah.
Basically, we have no faith that USF is going to be good on purpose. The only two possible positives I could spin out of it are, A, that they do have the best recruiting classes in the AAC from the past 2 or 3 years. And so there is a lot of talent on that roster, at least relatively to the rest of the conference.
Absolutely.
And even bad coaches can occasionally win with good talent. And so there is the slightest possibility that USF will wind up being decent by accident. I don't think it's going to happen, because I think there's too much going on with the scheme, and they don't have a quarterback and they don't have an offensive line. So I don't think it's going to happen. But the other good thing, and this is actually what gives me some sort of hope for the future, is that one way or another, I believe that 2015 will be the end of the slide for USF, because either the unlikely happens and Willie Taggart pulls a rabbit out of his hat and we're all, you know, eating our words, and he gets the program back on track, highly unlikely, or he is fired at the end of the year or in the middle of the year, even if we're being ambitious, and they get a new coach in there who hopefully under the new athletic director, whose hires have been solid so far, and hopefully can understand the mistakes they made with hiring Willie Taggart and his very ill-fitting system, and get a new guy in there who can inherit a lot of talent. They're going to get a big-time transfer quarterback in 2016, and there is more than enough talent that if they get to relatively mediocre this year, step in there and win right away with the right scheme and the right coaching staff. So I do believe that there's a strong chance that 2015 will be the last year that USF really, really sucks for a while. But I do believe that they're going to really, really suck this year. So that's where I'm at.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. And I mean, I kind of agree is that talent takes a while to actually show dividends. And like you said, however it plays out, whatever which way it happens, this is Willie Taggart's probably his last season here at the helm, barring something really good happening.
Yes, definitely.
And so, like you said, that new coach is going to inherit a very talented squad, like you said, relative to the rest of the conference. So, interestingly enough, that's when I think UConn will make its reappearance into bowl contention, at least. Should be a pretty interesting time. So then, okay, if that's the situation, if you're feeling so down about 2015 and you know, basically hoping to be surprised, cratering expectations so that anything halfway decent feels great, what are kind of the storylines? What are the big things that you're looking for on this team? I mean, switch to the spread offense, you know, what are some of the kind of the big talking points going on in USF country these days?
I think that the main things that at least I personally will be looking out for this season are which, you know, we have a lot of young, theoretically talented players who should be coming into their own, you know, breaking into the starting lineup this season. And if they're not breaking into the starting lineup this season, then they're probably never going to break into the starting lineup. So just looking, especially on offense, because I think the defense will be okay in the long run. I really do. I think they have enough guys there, and they have a scheme now that fits their strengths. But seeing if there is a quarterback on the roster that can play for us in the future. I mean, like I said, we have a transfer from UCLA who has a very storied history with USF and, you know, four-star quarterback. Committed to USF, decommitted, committed to USF, decommitted, committed to UCLA, transferred back to USF. And he might be the heir incumbent there, but Quentin Flowers is still on the roster. He's a very talented athlete, if not a very talented quarterback, at least at this point. Can he play? Can he run a spread offense? You know, will Marlon Back, you know, be the offensive player of the year? Is he going to continue to progress in the new offense? Do they have some receivers they can throw to? Is the offensive line going to collapse on itself like it did last year? You know, just looking for players who we can count on in the future for when probably a new coach takes over next year, he has a base to work with. And as many guys that are halfway decent as possible, that's really what I'm looking for. I'm trying to find out who is going to be here for the future of USF football.
All right.
Which sounds unbearably depressing.
It sounds
but
Philadelphia 76ers 2015-2016.
It really does, actually. That is a very interesting comparison. Unfortunately, there's no reward for tanking here.
Yeah, there's no picks in college football, unfortunately.
It'd be great if, you know, UConn and USF every year could, you know, then just take the top recruit out of high school, whichever one they wanted. I'd love that.
Yeah, just tell one player, you have to go to UConn.
Exactly.
I mean, that's kind of what it's like think about the NFL. It's like in any other job, right, you get hired by a company and you kind of pick the office. Let's just kind of make an analogy. You know, you kind of pick the office that you want to work at, or you have, you know, some sort of choices if it's a big national company. But in the NFL, you may end up being randomly selected for the Buffalo office or the Jacksonville office.
Which is just, like, truly upsetting. And I understand that it's, like, a huge moment for these people. But, like, man, if I am the number one prospect in the NFL draft, especially, like a quarterback or something,
yeah,
and like the Browns take me,
Yeah.
I mean, I am visibly upset. I could not keep my poker face on.
Yeah, I mean, there's players who have done it. There's your Elways, your Mannings. Those are the big ones that come to mind. I can't think of anyone else who's done something. But I mean, it's there. Elway had some real leverage. He had a contract from the Yankees, so he could really – he had a good amount of leverage. Mm-hmm. Eli Manning somehow made it happen. Jim Kelly, actually – I'm a Bills fan. Jim Kelly, actually –
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Interestingly enough, Jim Kelly did not want to play for the Buffalo Bills, and that's where he did that one-year stint with the Houston Gamblers in the USFL before eventually being convinced to come to Buffalo. So,
which also worked out well for everybody in the end.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's now like king of Buffalo, basically. So, yeah, besides that quick NFL draft tangent, yeah, that's where we are. Did anyone from USF get drafted this past year?
Yeah, we had two players drafted in the late rounds, which was a very pleasant surprise because I was not expecting anyone. We had a linebacker, Rashard Clyatt, who definitely deserved it. He was, used to play safety, switched to linebacker, was very productive. He'll probably be a safety in the pros, I would think. He's a smaller guy, faster guy.
Mm-hmm.
And a center, Austin Ryder, which was definitely USF's best offensive lineman, but I'll admit that I was surprised because USF's best offensive lineman is like,
yeah.
You know, I can think of 1,000 inappropriate metaphors here and I will use none of them.
Yeah.
But at any rate, that was nice. But, you know, at the risk of sounding upsetting, I'm really not upset about the future of the USF football program unless they really, really mess up the next hire. But we have no reason to believe as of yet that will happen. You know, their new athletic director really seems to get it, made a good hire in basketball, I believe. And if he can get the right guy in there, I really think that within a few seasons, USF will be, you know, they're not going to be a top 25 team by any means, but I think they'll be up and running again as opposed to the last, you know, 5 years that we've had to put up with. So while this year might be a drag to get through, I am actually, for the first time in a while, optimistic for the future, although it's not particularly optimistic for the future under Willie Taggart.
Yeah.
At any rate, I'm sure that UConn still believes in Bob Diaco at this point. Is that right?
I mean, it's getting tougher and tougher every day. I do have to say, I personally am in the wait and give him time camp. So I'm not, I mean, I'm saying, yes, some questionable things happened last year, shutting down the passing game, trying a two-headed quarterback situation, a lot of other things. But, you know, I'm always in the camp of giving them time in this kind of situation and just acknowledging the situation that he inherited. There are some people who are firmly in the anti-Diaco camp already after 1 year.
I think it's – I mean, he could turn out to be Willie Taggart part two for all I know. I mean, that he could very well turn out to be that, but I think it is far too soon to tell.
Exactly. And that's what I keep trying to say. And, you know, I think our 2016 recruiting, it got off to a slow start, but it was supposed to be a small class anyway. So I don't know how that affects the timing of getting recruits. And I mean, we didn't have our first 2016 commitment until, I want to say like June 18th or something like that, you know, which is fairly late in the game.
Yeah.
But we now, and again, it's supposed to be a small class. We have a small senior class leaving, and I would say it's probably going to be 13, 14, 15 guys in the incoming class. And so far we have six, and five of them have three-star ratings on Rivals 24/7, et cetera, et cetera. So, and for us, that's really good.
Yeah, it's really good. Absolutely.
So we're pretty excited for that. I mean, I'm pretty excited for that. I think some people have dozed on UConn football after the past 5 years, you know, and rightfully so. But
understandably, yeah.
I mean, the fact that there is still interest among recruits for this program and the way that the coaches are running things is encouraging. And you know, we just gotta give them time. I have to ask, because I always chuckle a little bit when I see USF doing so well in recruiting. I'm always like, what is that kid thinking? He's got other options. Does he know he has?
I do not blame you.
So what's happening? How do you think Taggart is such a good recruiter?
I think it goes down to a couple of things, because I think giving Taggart credit, he has always been a good recruiter. He's energetic. He's a young guy. You know, I bet if I had a face-to-face with Willie Taggart right now, he could sell me on this next season. I truly believe that. And, you know, different coaches are good at different things. Willie Taggart is probably a guy that you definitely want on your staff, and he will probably be on Michigan's staff next year because he knows Jim Harbaugh. Did you know that? So he – part of that is definitely him. Part of that is Willie Taggart is a very good recruiter, and I don't know what special skill he has, but he is a salesman, and he can do that. And, you know, if you listen to one of his press conferences, and now they're a little bit more solemn than they used to be. But back in the day, I mean, even when they were struggling, you believed that he was going to drive the bus, if you will,
yeah,
and get the ship turned around. And so he's a good recruiter. At the same time, I think that USF, at least right now, kind of sells itself in that they are still right now, although the gap is small, the fourth choice among Florida recruits who want to stay in Florida. You know, they're not in the same, you know, atmosphere right now as Florida, FSU, or Miami. And, you know, they probably will not be for a very long time, if ever. You know, that might have been the closest they've ever gotten a few years back. But the point is that even with suffering the worst years of their program, and UCF going through the best years of their program, recruits are still going to USF as opposed to UCF. And I think that is something that is really important. And if USF fans want like a general state of the program, just keep an eye out for that. Because I think if, you know, say Willie Taggart has another bad year, gets fired, and the next coach comes in and is not doing anything, I really think that their spot on the totem pole could slip below UCF, and I think that would be very dangerous for them, especially in the ever-present world of realignment.
Sure.
I think that that would be bad, but I do think that once USF gets things turned around, and I use the word once because I'm really, really trying to be optimistic here, I think that they should be able to, with the caliber of athlete they're pulling in now, they should be able to be on the top of the American on a regular basis. And so, like, I mean, you look at the rest of the teams in the American and you look at USF and UCF too. I mean, like, where would you want to go? You know, you can play in Tampa, in Florida, you know, especially these Florida kids, you know, they want to stay close to home, and you know, they can't get an offer from Miami or Florida State. So they go to USF. And I mean, you look at that as compared to, oh, should I go to USF, who's been down lately, or should I go to, you know, Temple, who sold this year, but is also, you know, miles from home, gets similarly no fan support, and doesn't seem to really have that much better of a future. You know, I'd still pick USF personally. So I understand why they're recruiting well. I just hope that they turn the ship around soon enough that they don't lose that recruiting edge over the rest of the conference.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when you mentioned Willie Taggart and you said, you know, there might be a Bob Diaco might be a Willie Taggart, it kind of reminded me of Diaco the way you were describing him, is that, you know, he is a tremendous salesperson of the program. You know, we were, when Bob Diaco had his introductory speech and he talked about energy vampires and quoted Garth Brooks, and, you know, other, you know, in the same sentence, you know, people were really excited about it and what kind of element he would bring. And, you know, he's bringing in the recruits, but he is kind of developing that reputation of like a snake oil salesman of just kind of being very much having a face and, you know, and just, I mean, if you're successful, they call it marching to the beat of your own drum. If you're not, they call it being an a-hole. And right now, I guess people are leaning towards calling Bob Diaco kind of a clueless a-hole. And one of those examples is in the recently formed hot rivalry game that has the American Athletic Conference buzzing, the civil conflict, because UConn is the northernmost school in the AAC. And to quote the UConn Athletic Department, UCF is one of the most. So this makes
sense. I didn't even think about that. UCF is not the most southern school in the AAC.
Yeah, no,
they tried.
They said one of the most southern.
That is really funny. Look, I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I'll let you go first.
Yeah, okay. So, obviously, at first glance, you are, you know, as a UConn fan, you're thinking, what the hell? You're especially thinking that when USF's athletic department, or sorry, UCF's athletic department publicly denied any involvement in the creation of this rivalry game. And that's when you're really like, okay, Bob, what is it exactly that you're doing here? Now, calm down a little bit. I mean, there's nothing wrong with internally, when you are UConn, the team, putting a target on the back of the, you know, what has been the dominant team in the conference, in its 2 years of existence.
Yeah. I nearly just vomited in my mouth, but go on.
I know, I'm sorry. It's true. You know, is putting that target on that team. And I don't know, to me, it's kind of like when you're the smallest guy, you know, you walk into a bar and you point at the biggest guy in there and you tell him you're going to beat the crap out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just trying to, you know, establish something. And I mean, people can make fun of them as much as they want. It's not going to affect Bob Diaco. That's for sure. It's not going to affect the staff. It's not going to affect the UConn players who are amped about it. And if it gives them a little extra juice every time they take the field against UCF, who we just beat last year, all the better. Again, I understand. It's very embarrassing the way it all played out. I wrote an article in defense of it that was actually just a pure troll of Syracuse. listed a whole bunch of things that Syracuse did that had happened to them really within the past year that are more embarrassing than something like what happened with UConn and the civil conflict saga. Yeah.
I, from a neutral perspective, like obviously when the thing first came out, it was very silly. I mean, like you just didn't know what to think about it.
Yeah.
I really don't have an issue with it, especially because of just how it was generally received. Because I really thought what the outcome was going to be. And I think there are people who will do this, and I hate every single one of them passionately. I think there are UCF fans who are going to say, look, like, we wanted to be your rival, and you said no. Now you want to be our rival, but we're rivals with UConn now. Like, see you later. And I honestly thought that was the approach that UCF was going to take to it. And I was not looking forward to the inevitable vomiting on each other that the two fan bases would be doing. But the fact that UCF was like, look, this is cool with us, but we don't know where this came from, really. I actually appreciated that more because it seemed like, you know, we knew what was happening here. UConn was just taking a shot at the big dog, which was, I don't have a problem with that, you know. It's kind of funny. And it just makes Bob Diaco even weirder and have more of an aura to him. And, you know, honestly, if I were a UConn player and after UCF was like, we don't know anything about this, I'd want to beat him even more, you know? So I think it's pretty funny. I think it's pretty harmless as is. And the fact that no one read UCF fans has taken this as a, you know, tried to turn this into something bigger than it is, I'm pretty fine with it. I really do think, without delving too far into this, because we're not discussing the finer details of USF, UCF, but you know, if everyone just sat down in those two fan bases and said, hey, we hate each other more than we hate anything else. That's a rivalry. We should both consider that we are rivals. I think everyone would just be so much happier. I really think that has a potential for an awesome, fun series. But USF fans, a lot of them, are still clinging to this belief that, you know, they are on a higher ground than UCF, which, as of right now, is not true. I mean, higher moral ground, I won't get into that, but you know, right now it's not true. And UCF fans are taking their few years of success and saying, look, now we're better than you. You don't deserve us anymore. And it just makes for a very, very odd dynamic from both sides. Neither one wants to claim the other one. And I just think it would be so much better if we both just accepted that we are rivals and we will be stuck with each other until the end of time. But anyway, that was a long
No, but I, you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, this is kind of like you said. I mean, this model has existed for a very long time, where there's a school who kind of thinks of another school as their rival, and everyone hates each other. But because one school looks down on the other one, they say, "Well, no, you're not our rival. Come on." You know, like, you know, one example is, and there's a chain of it. I can even make a chain, but it'd be like Notre Dame Boston College. You know, you ask someone from Notre Dame about the Notre Dame Boston College, and they go, "Whatever, it's Boston College." People from Boston College think it's the greatest rivalry in all of sports, but actually, if you ask someone from Notre Dame, they go, "Eh." Same thing, you know, UConn and Boston College, we think there's potential for a rivalry there. They go, "Eh." UConn and Syracuse, we think of us as having a rivalry with Syracuse because of all those basketball games. And you ask a Syracuse fan, and they go, "Eh." So there's always – and then same with UCF and USF. There's always kind of an unwilling party when you're trying to make a rivalry happen. So, you know, I just kind of see this as one of those things that will smooth off over time.
Yeah, and these things happen that, you know, the original UCF-USF series, I mean, they were like, we're naturally should be rivals. Let's start playing each other. And that, you know, you could say it worked out. You know, USF won all the games, so it didn't work out that well. But, you know, it wasn't bad. And I think kind of the whole conference, you know, debacle with UCF getting in and then getting better than USF, that's what really, I think, spurred on the hate and the rivalry. And if both sides could accept that now, I think there would really be something good there. And it's like with, you know, UConn and UCF, like, you know, even if UCF had said, yes, you know, this is great, we love the civil conflict, it won't be a rivalry until you start feeling like they're your rival on the field for whatever reason. I don't mean are as good as you are or anything, but just when you have enough memorable games and stuff. And so like the fact that Syracuse fans wouldn't consider UConn a rival is baffling to me. I mean, that's stupid.
It's just a comical superiority complex that they have.
Yeah. I mean, that's really, really silly. But cause that's something that, you know, sure they were in a similar situation, but there's nothing really tying UConn and Syracuse together, but they've had so many memorable games and so many big moments in the two schools' history.
Yeah, no, I know, especially in basketball, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the first thing about the UConn-Syracuse history of football. I will not lie to you.
Not much,
yeah. Yeah, but in basketball, absolutely. And so getting over all the politics of it, it's just I feel like you know when you've kind of achieved that. And UConn and UCF, perhaps they will achieve that soon. I don't know. I think UConn and USF actually, you know, kind of have a little bit of, I don't know. There's no real like hate going on between the two fan bases, I don't think. But like, I think most people who are actually into the programs, you know, who are not casual fans, would list UConn among USF's biggest rivals. And yeah, I'm sorry, but that's for no other reason than the fact that they just have played a lot of weirdly memorable games.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I tend to agree. And yeah, it's, I mean, the only thing is that our fan bases are respectable to each other and there's no real hatred. Yeah, I don't know. It's something that will develop over time. I mean, you know, I definitely hate Cincinnati football and basketball, whatever, you know, whatever the sport is. I definitely hate Cincinnati.
There's definitely more with UConn Cincinnati than there is with USF Cincinnati. We don't have much of a relationship with them.
But anyway, yeah, these things will all take time. In 1980, there was nothing on the basketball court between UConn and Syracuse, and then it did. So, yeah.
But back to Bob Diaco, as we all started this.
Yeah, sure.
When you mentioned that, like, you felt a lot of similarities with how we were describing Willie Taggart and Bob Diaco's first season, I mean, that is a feeling that I have not been able to shake about Bob Diaco. And I don't think it has any bearing on whether or not he's going to be successful. But his first year almost seemed like a carbon copy of Willie Taggart's first year, except for the fact that he did not lose by 30 points to McNeese State, which is a huge advantage in his favor. But I really – like, they seemed very, very identical, and I feel like a lot of – please correct me if I'm wrong. You can talk about this. But a lot of how he is going to be viewed by UConn is going to depend on the progress they make this season. Had Willie Taggart gone 6-6 this year, everyone would love him. But really he didn't. So I feel like this is a big year for UConn. Maybe not the payoff year, but certainly a big one.
You're right. No, absolutely. The problem is that it's going to be difficult to kind of actually gauge whether or not there's improvement because, you know, as you know, I think you wrote something about this about USF last year, but, you know, the win total does not necessarily reflect whether or not there's improvement. And so for that reason, you know, we might still win two games this year, but be better than we were last year. And I don't think many people are on board with that. And I mean, we have a pretty tough schedule. I mean, the AAC, for all, you know, for all the jokes, you know, it's a pretty decent conference. And then USF, I know, always plays tough out of conference games, and we're playing this year Missouri and BYU and Villanova out of conference. So
yeah, those are three good games for sure.
Yeah. So we'll definitely see. One last thing before we talk about some other stuff to kind of close the loop on coaches and rivalries and things like that. What do you make of UCF naming George O'Leary interim athletic director?
My goodness, I think that is absolutely hilarious.
Right?
And the thing, I'm giving credit to Colin here. He always mentions when we talk about UCF, UCF is a house of cards. And that is not to say that UCF is a terrible program. It's not to say that, you know, they are going to be like really bad for the future. No, they have a decent program going, you know, but they got to where they are by not holding people responsible for their actions, having a very ridiculously run athletic department, you know, not holding George O'Leary accountable for all the terrible things that he's done as coach there. And there are quite a few of them. And as such, while I think they're going to be perfectly fine, they don't have anything to worry about. Right now, I don't think they have a sustainable base as a long-term program because I think a lot of their success has been a result of questionable decision-making, whereas the opposite is true for USF, where they've had questionable decision-making, which has put them in a hole. At any rate, it was kind of like a reinforcement of that fact. The fact that they promoted George O'Leary to be an interim athletic director really makes me think that they have not figured it out. And I might be making too big of a blanket statement about an athletic department that I am not intimately familiar with.
Yeah.
But that really seems to me like a weird move and a move that shows that they are just not on the right path in general. And clearly it's a good football coach, so they'll do fine in the near future. But athletic director just seems bizarre to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the role of athletic director versus head football coach are so remarkably different. And you know, when you think about the business acumen that you would like to have, you know, at the head of your athletic department, you know, do you think a George O'Leary can, you know, is do you think a George O'Leary can fit or meet or succeed, fit or meet those criteria or succeed in that kind of office environment, the networking environment, all those kind of things that come with being the AD? I mean, is there someone else doing some of that other stuff? How do you be a head coach / athletic director, head football coach / athletic director?
That is really baffling to me. And really, if God forbid there is a UCF fan listening to this podcast right now, I mean, like I would really like to hear the counterpoint to that, because I'm not challenging them. I'm genuinely curious. I mean, it just seems like a very, very strange move. And I mean, I haven't seen something from UCF side of things that say any arguments besides, you know, George O'Leary is the face of the university, which is perfectly true, although a horrifying statement. But I mean, face of the university does not equal athletic director. So, I mean, I am very open to interpretations of how that makes sense, but I don't see it.
Yeah. Well, if you are a UCF fan and you've made it this far, thank you very much. I commend you.
Congratulations.
And you will be rewarded with a segment on what the internet tells me is your most favoritist topic in the entire great world, and that is conference realignment. So, you know, there's a lot of people, first, you know, speaking of George O'Leary as AD, you know, interim athletic director, that
Lord,
that must be some sort of play towards potential or imminent conference realignment, I have to imagine, right? Is there,
can you imagine being like the Big 12 commissioner and like picking up your phone and it's George O'Leary?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know. I don't, yeah.
That would be terrifying. I would throw the phone far away, but that's me. I'm not the Big 12 commissioner.
What's his, is anyway. That Bowlesby?
Yes, yes.
Obviously, there is a lot of noise in conference realignment. There is a huge, huge rumor mill that is always, always spinning. We're going to work on doing a regular segment that we're going to call This Week in Conference Realignment, where hopefully we touch on actual relevant news points within this very intriguing arena, which has no timeline for when things will happen, and they just kind of do. And there's a bunch of people of varying levels of expertise and connections trying to read tea leaves.
Oh, yes.
But I do think there is, I mean, there's a couple, but one really, really relevant piece of news that came out was the Oklahoma athletic director making it known that the Big 12, if they were to add someone during their new TV contract, they do not need to share their pie. The networks will compensate them with a, you know, will make up that difference. So, Ryan, I think that's a pretty interesting and relevant news when we talk about when is the timing of another one of these shifts in conference realignment, right? Particularly when paired with the Big 12's want or desire to have a championship game.
Yeah, it really seems like the first bit of substantial news regarding Big 12 expansion that we got wind of for the last, I don't even know, quite some time. You know, the rumor mill is always spinning. And there are always West Virginia bloggers out there tweeting out random things. But that seemed like the first substantial bit that the Oklahoma athletic director, who, while not the kingpin of the Big 12, is certainly among the elite.
Oh, certainly.
Saying that he would be in favor of 12 teams. And I do think that as UConn and USF fans, as far as timing is concerned, we don't want Big 12 realignment to happen tomorrow. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. We don't want any realignment to happen tomorrow. Maybe you can go into how you feel. Our Big 12 situation is a little bit different from yours, but yes, yes. We want to wait until we're somewhat better at football before people start thinking realignment again. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think, I mean, I don't think anything's going to happen in the near future with the Big 12, but I feel like a lot of USF fans are saying, you know, oh, thank goodness, you know, the wheel's starting to turn again. And I think you should pump the brakes a little bit there, because if the wheel really were to start turning, which I don't think it has, that would not be good.
Yeah, I mean, I agree for slightly different reasons. I don't think UConn is on the Big 12's shortlist today. I don't think it is 5 years from now, you know, even if we get decent at football because of the geography. You know, I think for the Big 12, I mean, the kind of scenario that would involve UConn to the Big 12, what do you do? Take Temple and UConn and make a play for the Northeast? And yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so I think the sequence of events which would be beneficial for UConn would be that the Big 12 snags someone from the Big 10 or ACC, which opens up
a spot there.
Which opens up a spot for UConn. You know, that's the only scenario I see this, the Big 12, two potential Big 12 openings playing out in a favorable fashion for UConn. And
the way I see it with, I was thinking about this the other day with UConn and, you know, the ACC or the Big Ten. If one of those two conferences were to expand, which we haven't heard much about, you'd have to think that UConn would be one of the first teams on their shortlist, right? I mean, who else, if the ACC were to look for another team. But where else will they look?
I mean, so here, you know, the thing is, you never know, right? Because Rutgers joined the Big Ten. But
yes, great point.
You know, I mean, the ACC could take Temple. They could take East Carolina. They could take.
Oh Lord.
I mean, you know, they just took Louisville. So, you know, it's not. There's no. You know, don't expect rhyme or reason when we're talking about conference realignment, because
that's a great point.
We don't really know what the guys in the conference rooms are actually talking about. We have a decent guess: TV ratings, size of the fan base, buying power, and geographic spread of alumni. But at the, you know, how good the football program is obviously matters.
Unfortunately,
right. At the end of the day, who knows what happens? Not, at this point, having watched, like I said, Rutgers and Louisville get the call over UConn, nothing would surprise me at this point. I'm trying to think of anyone else. I mean, you're right. There's not a huge pool if the ACC or Big Ten were looking. I mean, I think anyone who's a fan of those conferences is hoping that they poach from another Power Five conference.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it seems that UConn is in a really interesting spot because, you know, the imminent or quote imminent realignment, the most imminent of any conferences looking to realign, which is still probably several years down the road, is the Big 12. And while I think UConn is not an unattractive expansion candidate, I really don't. I don't think they make any sense for the Big 12.
They make no sense.
Were the, like we said, ACC or Big 10 to open up, I mean, it would really confuse me if they looked to Temple before UConn, for example.
No, absolutely.
That would make no sense to me.
Absolutely. Especially if it's the Big Ten. I mean, UConn is a flagship state university, you know, a top 20 public school in the country now. You know, it's been on a rapid rise the past 20 years, you know, academically and athletically, not coincidentally. But yeah, I mean, you know, if those two schools are looking, but I don't know what the incentive is for those two schools to add someone unless, A, they are entering their next round of negotiations, which is 5, 7, 8 years down the road, or somebody steals one of their members. So
yeah, I mean, whatever happens, I think is still a ways away. And I think that is probably a good thing.
Yeah, well, it definitely is for us. But I think if Oklahoma, like you said, Oklahoma's athletic director, that is, you know, one notch below Texas's athletic director on their totem pole.
Absolutely.
You know, and if that's what he wants, maybe he can, you know, maybe he can pull the right levers to make that happen. And yeah, who knows what happens.
So here's the money question. If you were the Big 12 and you were to expand, let's say two teams, in a completely unbiased world, who are you taking?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd feel pretty good about taking Cincinnati. Consistent.
That's what I think, yeah.
Consistent football program, pretty solid basketball program, not going to slouch anywhere. They have good leadership. You know, they just renovated their football stadium. I would say them. And then, I mean, I have to say, to me, the most attractive ones are some of the other Texas ones. But I don't know if the Big 12 necessarily wants to add another Texas school, you know, understandably. But I think, just like if we're saying, you know, from an unbiased perspective, to me, Houston is an attractive one. SMU is an attractive one. But I don't know if the Big 12 would go with them.
I don't think Houston's a bad pick at all. And I'm usually very anti the idea of them taking another Texas school. And I think that it probably won't happen, but I don't think Houston would be a bad addition.
No, Houston would not be a bad addition. And then I think, you know, Memphis would be a devastating decision just because they were our football program 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, and had a basketball program coming off of a scandal, that would be tough for me, I think, if Memphis got the call.
You know, maybe there really is something to the Memphis, you know, rumblings. I mean, not that there have been many Memphis rumblings, but they certainly are in the conversation now. But, well, I mean, that would really, really surprise me if Memphis were to be added to the Big 12, because I mean that would just be kind of a statement that nothing really matters except what you've done in the last year or so, you know? Because I mean Memphis has so little history of any sort of success in football.
Yeah.
And would just kind of hit jackpot once and then parlayed that into a Big 12 invite. I mean, that would almost be kind of frightening to me. I would be very surprised if Memphis got taken. But, yeah. You know, I'm not the people in charge. You know, they are in a decent market. And
they're
built up some sort of fan base.
There's a, you know, there's a football rabid base there for sure. And it maybe it helps create a bridge for West Virginia a little bit.
Sure.
You know, I think the Florida expansion thing is interesting because I would think if you want one Florida team, you should just take them both is kind of how I feel. You know,
I would also agree with that.
Is to kind of go, you know, jump in with both feet if you're trying to be a presence in the state of Florida. And then you would accomplish that. You would bring in two solid situations, USF and UCF, and you know, you'd be bringing Texas and Oklahoma and Texas Tech and whoever else, you know, Baylor, TCU. You'd be bringing all those guys into Florida, and you know, vice versa. I think everyone benefits, and then those Florida schools get to make visits to Texas and Oklahoma. You know, so I would think if it's going to be one Florida school, it's going to be both, because one of them on their own is not moving the dial so much, I don't think. But again, the Big Ten added Rutgers for the New York City market.
Yes.
Which, you know, which they have no piece of. You know, realistically speaking, they do not have a piece of. Legally and technically speaking, yes, there's a large number of Rutgers alumni in the New York City metro area, but most of them root for Penn State or not for college sports at all.
Yeah.
Is the fact of the matter. So anyway, anything can happen is what we have determined.
Yes. The conclusion here is that we have no idea, and that for all we know, it's going to be Tulane.
Yeah, Tulane. I was just about to say Tulane's an interesting candidate too, because they're in a major city. They are the most academically reputable out of the AAC, for whatever that's worth. And then you know, again, the ACC just added Louisville, so for whatever that is worth. They're in New Orleans. You know, there's a lot of potential there too. So there's a lot of candidates, and that's why I, you know, Temple, it's in Philadelphia. If it's in the Northeast, I don't know.
How about we haven't discussed the idea of them moving west with a Boise State or a BYU? Think there's any merit to that?
Yeah, I think I think Boise State would be a great addition for them. Absolutely. And I don't know. They can't possibly be that. I might fudge my U.S. geography here, but they can't possibly be that far from Iowa State, can they? I mean, Iowa's above Missouri. It's okay. No, it's pretty far.
It's pretty far, but considering that they did have Colorado in the Big 12 until recently, I mean,
right.
That's only a few states north, and this is the podcast in which we learn that Ryan and Amon have no idea where states are.
So, So Boise State, I think, makes a lot of sense. There's definitely, I mean, it's a tremendous football program, and they haven't missed a beat, even though they've lost head coach after head coach. And, you know, I mean, they're not in a major metro market, but they own a state for whatever that's worth.
Yeah.
And, but BYU, I don't know what their incentive is really to join a conference. They seem to be doing pretty well for themselves as independents. And I mean, because of their, you know, religious situation, I don't know that they are ever angling to be the next Alabama or Texas or what have you. So BYU, I've heard their coach say some things about needing to be in a conference, wanting to be in a conference. And if that's the case, you know, he can accept the Colorado job, you know, when he's offered it or whatever. But,
yeah.
You know, I don't know if BYU ever leaves the independent ranks unless the Pac-12 were to come in with a Godfather offer. But that's sure. Again, yeah. just one person's sense.
Yeah, I really, the more we talk about it, and it's just not something that people discuss very often, because all of the talk is about potential viewers, yeah, and like, you know, Boise State does not seem like an awful choice to me, and perhaps I'm just being incredibly short-sighted and saying that, hey, they have the best football program, but I mean, you have Texas and Oklahoma in your conference. People are going to watch, and out of the schools that are left, Boise State is the biggest name brand, which is kind of frightening, but they really are. And I mean, maybe UConn could actually make a case for that, but not in football.
No.
And yeah. Out of football, I mean, Boise State gets people to watch, you know, the game, and maybe not people in Idaho to watch the game, but certainly people tune in for a Boise State, Oklahoma conference game. That sounds awesome. I mean, I'd watch that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, I mean, considering with the incredibly large caveat that, you know, my standards are probably incredibly different than the Big 12 standards. And if they are looking to expand, they're probably looking for, you know, literal, how many more people can we get watching us? How much more money can we get? And trying to work that out in a right. mathematical sense, and not just saying, oh, Boise State is a good football team.
Yeah.
But how many, I really think they could do worse than go there.
How many hundreds of thousands of viewers can we add to our conference's geographic footprint?
Yeah. And, I mean, in that sense, I mean, maybe – it really depends what they're looking for. I mean, I don't think Cincinnati adds anything in terms of, like, your viewership, really. I think Cincinnati is a very safe choice. I think they'd be competitive.
Yeah.
And I think they would not make your conference any weaker. But I don't think Cincinnati is moving any dials. I mean, USF and UCF are moving dials, but you also have the possibility of those two teams being absolute dead weight in your conference, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly that's not that big of a concern because Rutgers. But, I mean, I think there are real pros and cons to each of them, which is the weakest conclusion ever. But, I mean... At the end of the day, I don't think that adding Boise State is like the worst thing in the world, especially if you were to bring in BYU and make it kind of geographically make sense. Yeah. But what do I know?
Right, exactly. Speaking of adding teams to conferences, though, the AAC went out. Well, they didn't go out. This happened about 3 years ago as the Big East was collapsing at the seams. But it officially happened on July 1st of this year, where the United States Naval Academy was added to the ranks of the American Athletic Conference. How patriotic. I, for one, am pretty excited about this addition for a number of reasons. I think it's kind of like BYU in the sense that there is a national fan base for the Navy.
Absolutely.
There's actually some history to this football program with, Roger Staubach, and they have one other Heisman Trophy winner. They give us a good away opponent. Good away destination mm-hmm. in Annapolis. Oh, well, and it's a good football team right now. Right now it's a good football
Absolutely,
team.
Absolutely, yeah. Probably one of the better ones right away.
Exactly. There's a very good chance they win the AAC West this year. So they improve the level of competition. They, by the way, they let us have a championship game. They increased the size of the conference's audience. It sounds to me like it's win, 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 win when the AAC adds Navy. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that as far as the AAC is concerned, Navy is pretty much the best addition they could make. Talking to someone the other day and about, you know, if you were to take the teams in, you know, the group of five teams and assemble something that you wanted to present as a potential Power Five conference, I don't think I would take Navy with me because I think that, you know, they are the U.S. Naval Academy. Football is never going to be their number one priority. And that's okay. That's great. You know, they're doing just fine as they are. But in a mid-major conference, I think they are a fantastic addition. I really do.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, I mean, you could You could make the argument, again, because of that national fan base, because of all those things I said, any Oklahoma or other Big 12 athletic directors who are listening to this highly critically acclaimed podcast,
yes,
might feel the need to just snag Navy from right under the AAC. But anyway, like I said, I mean, I'm excited to make a visit to Annapolis. It's a beautiful place to go anytime. Obviously, a lot of fanfare associated with those games, and obviously a lot of very honorable individuals who play on those teams and are associated with that, you know, with that school. So good on you, AAC. And hopefully this leads or shows or pays some dividends when it comes time for the conference to get into renegotiations with its TV contract.
Yeah, that would be extremely helpful. It certainly won't hurt.
Yeah, because that's really the one thing. You know, you say, okay, well, the AAC, the teams are not that bad. Like I have said, you know, there's some teams that are okay, and there's some teams that are on the up and up. But everyone's been investing in their programs. You know, USF, you know, with their basketball program is a great example. Orlando Antigua ain't coming to USF if USF is in Conference USA.
Sure, absolutely.
So I think, you know, Kelvin Sampson isn't going to Houston if they're not in the AAC. You know, these guys, they're not going to those schools if they're in Conference USA. So I'm definitely optimistic about the AAC, but this money thing is definitely going to be an issue because we're talking about AAC teams. I'm fuzzy on the numbers here because I frankly don't care about them that much, but it's something like $3 to $5 million per year for an AAC team, I think. And then something in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 or 25, even when you're talking bottom end of the Power Five.
And I mean, that is a huge gap, and it will probably only get bigger.
Yeah. Well, unless with some juice from Navy and some, I don't know how TV contract negotiations work, but it seems like everyone gets overpaid. So that'll be Mike Oresko's job to try and make that happen because we can't, you know, we can't get by on $3 million a year. UConn, I mean, UConn has really nice football facilities. They're about 5 years old. We just got a new basketball facility. We're building a new soccer stadium and practice facility. We're building a new hockey arena.
Ice bus,
yes, indeed. But, you know, let's take a mediocre P5 team like a Syracuse or a Boston College or a Purdue or whoever you want, Indiana, Illinois, you know, those guys, they're getting $20 million a year. And if they want to have facilities that match up to UConn's, they can do that in short order.
Yep.
For the basketball facility. So I think the biggest winners here are those mid-level and mediocre P5 schools that are all going to start a little bit of a lift. And that is unfortunate because those schools have done nothing to be where they are today.
Yeah, it's just – it's frustrating because, you know, USF and probably UConn too, in a level playing field, would out-recruit Indiana, Iowa State, Syracuse – and probably have while they were all in BCS leagues together. Now there is a huge reason to go to Indiana as opposed to, you know, Indiana might be a bad example. They're not the most downtrodden program out there, but regardless, you know.
No, but they could. But with the $25 million a year they're getting, they can get a new head coach, get a new football facility, and have money left over to pay
these
players.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, we won't
and
have that.
It's just a really – I really think that I don't know when or if it will happen. And people, you know, people have said for a long time, you know, USF has too much going for it to not be good at football eventually. And I agree with that. They're going to be good, but they will not be great in the American. And if they want to eclipse good, then they have to find a way to get into a Power Five league or get more money. And so I don't know when or if that will happen, but it's pretty much an ultimatum there.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Definitely some interesting times ahead with TV contract renegotiations, potential realignment, an actual football season to be played.
That's the least interesting part, unfortunately.
And definitely some recruiting to track. Ryan and I have ranted enough for you guys today, so thank you all for making it this far. We hope you enjoyed the second installment of the Edge of Autonomy podcast. Just two guys hoping for their invite into the Power 5 party someday.
Please.
Unlike last time, we will actually be back next week with more AAC sports talk.
Hot AAC action.
That's right. That's what they're calling it. All right. Yep. Thanks, Ryan. See you next week.
See ya.